the anti-gay campaign was to transform demands for democracy into a nebulous threat to Russian innocence. Voting equals West equals sodomy. Russia had to be innocent, and all problems had to be the responsibility of others. The campaign did not depend on a factual demonstration of the heterosexuality of the Russian elite. In the previous 4 years, when Putin had been prime minister, Surkov had placed him in a series of fur and feathers photo shoots. Putin and Medvedev's attempt to present themselves as manly friends by posing in matching whites after badminton matches was similarly unconvincing. Putin divorced his wife just as his anti-gay campaign began, leaving the champion of family values without a traditional family. The question of gender identity clung to the Russian president. In 2016, Putin asserted that he was not a woman who has bad days. In 2017, he denied that he was Donald Trump's groom. That year, it became a criminal offense to portray Putin as a gay clown. An attentive female scholar summarized his position. Putin's kisses are reserved for children and animals. Putin was offering masculinity as an argument against democracy. As the German sociologist Max Weber argued, charisma can initiate a political system, but it cannot guarantee its continuity. It is normal, Weber observed, to form a political and commercial clan around a charismatic leader. But if that man wishes to go beyond redistributing the booty and planning the next raid, he must find a way to transfer his authority to someone else, ideally by a means that will allow power to be transferred again. Solving this problem of succession is the precondition of establishing a modern state. Weber defined two mechanisms that would allow a burst of charisma to become durable institutions. One, through custom, as for example in a monarchy, where the eldest son succeeded the father, or two, through law, as for example in a democracy where regular voting allows parliaments and rulers to be replaced. Putin did not seem to be planning a monarchical succession. He has kept his daughters at a distance from public politics, although the family did benefit from crony capitalism. The logical possibility that remains is thus law, which in the modern world usually means democracy. Putin himself dismissed this alternative, and so the display of masculinity provided a semblance of power at the expense of Russia's integrity as a state. During self-inflicted catastrophes of this kind, a certain kind of man always finds a way to blame a woman. In Vladimir Putin's case, that woman was Hillary Clinton. If the Kremlin's first impulse was to associate democratic opposition with global sodomy, its second was to claim that protesters worked for a foreign power, one whose chief diplomat was female, the United States. On December 8, 2011, 3 days after the protests began, Putin blamed Hillary Clinton for initiating them. She gave the signal. On December 15th, he claimed that the demonstrators were paid. Evidence was not provided and was not the point. If, as Eileen maintained, voting was just an opening to foreign influence, then Putin's job was to make up a story about foreign influence and use it to alter domestic politics. The point was to choose the enemy that best suited the leader's needs, not one that actually threatened the country. Indeed, it was best not to speak of actual threats, since discussing actual enemies would reveal actual weaknesses and suggest the fallibility of aspiring dictators. When Eileen wrote that the art of politics was identifying and neutralizing the enemy, he did not mean that statesmen should ascertain which foreign power actually posed a threat. He meant that politics began with a leader's decision about which foreign enmity will consolidate a dictatorship. Russia's real geopolitical problem was China, but precisely because Chinese power was real and proximate, considering Russia's actual geopolitics might lead to depressing conclusions. The West was chosen as an enemy precisely because it represented no threat to Russia. Unlike China, the EU had no army and no long border with Russia. The United States did have an army, but had withdrawn the vast majority of its troops from the European continent, from about 300,000 in 1991 to about 60,000 in 2012. NATO still existed, and had admitted former communist countries of Eastern Europe. But President Barack Obama had canceled an American plan to build a missile defense system in Eastern Europe in 2009, and in 2010, Russia was allowing American planes to fly through Russian airspace to supply American forces in Afghanistan. No Russian leader feared a NATO invasion in 2011 or 2012, or even pretended to. In 2012, American leaders believed that they were pursuing a reset of relations with Russia. When Mitt Romney referred to Russia as America's number one geopolitical foe in March 2012, he was ridiculed. Almost no one in the American public or media was paying attention to Moscow. Russia did not even figure in American public opinion polls about global threats and challenges. The European Union and the United States were presented as threats because Russian elections were faked. In winter 2011 and spring 2012, Russian television channels and newspapers generated the narrative that all who protested electoral fraud were paid by Western institutions. The effort began on December 8, 2011, with the reporting of Putin's claim that Clinton had initiated the protests. Under the headline, "Putin proposes tougher punishment for Western stooges," Novaya Izvestia reported his professed belief that the Russian opposition forces began mass protests after the go-ahead given by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The association between opposition and treason was axiomatic, the only question that of the appropriate punishment. In March, Russian television released a film described as a documentary, which claimed that Russian citizens who took to the streets were paid by devious foreigners. Precisely because Putin had made the Russian state vulnerable, he had to claim that it was his opponents who had done so. Since Putin believed that it would be inadmissible to allow the destruction of the state to satisfy this thirst for change, he reserved for himself the right to define views that he did not like as a threat to Russia. From 2012, there was no sense in imagining a worse Russia in the past and a better Russia in the future, mediated by a reforming government in the present. The enmity of the United States and the European Union had to become the premise of Russian politics. Putin had reduced Russian statehood to his oligarchical clan and its moment. The only way to head off a vision of future collapse was to describe democracy as an immediate and permanent threat. Having transformed the future into an abyss, Putin had to make flailing at its edge look like judo. In 2012, Putin made it clear that he understood democracy as ritualized support for his person. It meant, as he informed the Russian parliament in his annual address for that year, compliance with and respect for laws, rules, and regulations. Individual Russians had no right to protest against the anti-democratic actions of their government, on Putin's logic, since democracy required them to align their souls with laws that banned such protests. Putin was repeating Ilyin's understanding of both elections and law. Thus, freedom meant subordination to the words of an arbitrary leader. Indeed, after Putin's return to the office of president in May 2012, the Russian state was transformed in ways that corresponded to Ilyin's proposals. Every important measure brought to life an element of Ilyin's constitutional texts. Libel was made a criminal offense. A law that banned insults to religious sensitivities made the police the enforcer of an orthodox public sphere. It became a crime to publish cartoons of Jesus or to play Pokemon Go in a church. The authority and budget of the FSB were increased, and its officers granted broad authority to shoot without warning. A new FSB unit was named after Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Cheka, predecessor of the GRU, NKVD, KGB, and FSB. The definition of treason was expanded to include the provision of information to non-governmental organizations beyond Russia, which made telling the truth over email a high crime. Undefined extremism was outlawed. Non-governmental organizations deemed to work against Russia's interests were banned. Those that had received funding from abroad, a very general notion that included any form of international cooperation, such as holding a conference, were required to register themselves as foreign agents. On the morning that the foreign agent law went into effect, graffiti appeared across Moscow on the headquarters of non-governmental organizations reading "Foreign Agent USA." One target was Memorial, a storehouse of materials on the history of Russia in the 20th century. Russia's own past became a foreign threat. Memorial had documented the suffering of Soviet citizens, including Russians, during the Stalinist period. Of course, if all of Russia's problems came from the outside, there was little sense in dwelling on such matters. The politics of eternity destroys history. In the politics of eternity, the past provides a trove of symbols of innocence, exploited by rulers to illustrate the harmony of the homeland and the discord of the rest of the world. Putin's third response to the protests of 2011 and 2012 was to explicitly endorse and propagate Ilyin's version of the politics of eternity, to imagine Russia as a virginal organism troubled only by the threat of foreign penetration. On December 15, 2011, 10 days after the protests against electoral fraud began, and 2 decades after the dissolution of the USSR, Putin imagined a Russia where historical conflicts were literary problems. Sitting in a radio studio with the fascist writer Alexander Prokhanov, Putin mused about a Russia that would honor Soviet monuments to the terror against Soviet citizens, specifically to the Cheka and its founder Felix Dzerzhinsky. If something had gone wrong in Russian history, said Putin, it was the end of the Soviet Union. A historical event in which Putin's patron Yeltsin had been the central figure, and which had enabled Putin's own career, was now a mysterious passage to national malaise. What Russia needed, proposed Putin, was a different sense of the word revolution, a cycle that returned over and over to the same place. Can we say, Putin asked millions of radio listeners, that our country has fully recovered and healed after the dramatic events that have occurred to us after the Soviet Union collapsed, and that we now have a strong, healthy state? No, of course she is still quite ill, but here we must recall Ivan Ilyin. Yes, our country is still sick, but we did not flee from the bed of our sick mother. The remark suggested that Putin had been reading rather deeply in the Ilyin corpus, but his interpretation of the passage was odd. For Ilyin, it had been the foundation of the USSR, not its dissolution, that was the wound to Russia. Ilyin had wished to remain with his actual mother, but could not do so because he was expelled from the Soviet Union by the Cheka. Ilyin told his Cheka interrogator, "I consider Soviet power to be an inevitable historical outcome of the great social and spiritual disease which has been growing in Russia for several centuries." As a former KGB officer, Putin was a Chekist, as Russians still say, who wished to rule Russia through the Russian Orthodox Church. He wanted a reconciliation of what he called the traditions of red and white, communist and orthodox, terror and God. A sense of history would have required some confrontation with both aspects of Russian history. The politics of eternity allowed Putin the freedom to accept both red and white as innocent Russian responses to external threats. If all conflicts were the fault of the outsider, there was no need to consider Russians, their choices, or their crimes. The extreme right and left should instead be drawn together as a bicephalous icon. Putin banished contradictions. He oversaw a revival of Ilyin's work in which Ilyin's criticism of the Soviet Union was ignored. It would have been gauche to mention that Ilyin had recommended that Chekists be purged from politics in a post-Soviet Russia. In 2005, Putin had reburied Ilyin's corpse at a monastery where the Soviet secret state police had incinerated the corpses of thousands of Russian citizens executed during the Great Terror. At the moment of Ilyin's reburial, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church was a man who had been a KGB agent in Soviet times. At the ceremony, a military band struck up the Russian national anthem, which has the same melody as the Soviet national anthem. The man who seems to have exposed Putin to Ilyin's writings, the film director Nikita Mikhalkov, was the son of the composer responsible for both versions. Mikhalkov was an avid student of Ilyin, as his political manifesto reveals. Russia was a spiritual material unity, a thousand-year-old union of multiple nationalities and tribes, exhibiting a particular supranational imperial consciousness. Russia was the center of Eurasia, an independent cultural historic continent, organic, national unity, geopolitical and sacred, center of the world. When Putin laid flowers on Ilyin's grave in 2009, he was in the company of his favorite Orthodox monk, Tikhon Shevkunov, who was willing to see the Soviet executioners as Russian patriots. Putin himself, speaking a few years later, had no trouble seeing the values of communism as biblical. A certain ideology dominated in the Soviet Union, and regardless of our feelings about it, it was based on some clear, in fact, quasi-religious values. The moral code of the builder of communism, if you read it, is just a pathetic copy of the Bible. A number of Ilin's contemporaries had called Ilin a Czechist for God. He was reburied as such, with honors conferred by the Czechists and the Men of God, and by the Men of God who were Czechists, and by the Czechists who were Men of God. Ilin was returned, body and soul, to the Russia he had been forced to leave. And that very return, in its endorsement of contradiction and its disregard of fact, was the purest expression of respect for Ilin's tradition. To be sure, Ilin opposed the Soviet system. But once it no longer existed, it was history. And for Ilin, the facts of the past were nothing but raw material for the construction of a myth of innocence. Modifying Ilin's views ever so slightly, it was possible to see the Soviet Union not as an external imposition upon Russia, as he had seen it, but as Russia, and therefore immaculate. And so Russians could recall the Soviet system as an innocent Russian reaction to the hostility of the world. The rulers honored their own Soviet past by reburying an enemy of the Soviet Union. Vasily Grossman, the great Soviet novelist and chronicler of the crimes of National Socialism and Stalinism, wrote, "Everything flows, everything changes. You cannot enter the same transport twice." He meant transport to a concentration camp, and was referring to the adage of Heraclitus, "Everything flows, everything changes. You cannot step into the same river twice." In Ilin's sensibility, adapted by Putin, time was not a river flowing forward, but a cold round pool where ripples flowed ever inward toward a mysterious Russian perfection. Nothing new ever happened, and nothing new ever could happen. The West assaulted Russian innocence over and over again. History in the sense of the study of the past must be rejected, because it would raise questions. In Mihalkov's 2014 film Sunstroke, he had ethnic Russians sentenced to death by a female Jewish secret police officer, thereby suggesting that any unjust killing was done by people who might be considered alien by nationality or gender. In 2017, when Russia had to somehow address the centenary of the Bolshevik Revolution, Russian television aired a multi-part drama about Leon Trotsky, thereby coding the revolution as Jewish. The hero at the end of the drama was none other than Ivan Ilin. And so Russia celebrated a centennial of revolution by enshrining a counter-revolutionary philosopher who said that Russians should think of the past in terms of cycles of innocence. A lesson had been learned. As Putin endorsed Ilin's politics of eternity, he accepted Ilin's definition of the Russian nation. On January 23, 2012, just after the parliamentary elections and just before the presidential elections, Putin published an article in which he developed Ilin's understanding of the national question. By claiming that political opposition was sexual and foreign, Putin had already located all responsibility for Russian problems beyond the Russian Redeemer or the Russian Organism. By arguing that Russia was an inherently innocent civilization, Putin closed a logical circle. Russia was by its nature a producer and exporter of harmony and must be allowed to bring its variety of peace to its neighbors. In this article, Putin abolished the legal borders of the Russian Federation. Writing as its future president, he described Russia not as a state, but as a spiritual condition. Citing Ilin by name, Putin claimed that Russia had no conflicts among nationalities, and indeed could not have had any. The nationality question in Russia was, according to Ilin, an invention of enemies, a conceptual import from the West that had no applicability to Russia. Like Ilin, Putin wrote of Russian civilization as eliciting fraternity. "The great Russian mission," wrote Putin, "is to unify and bind civilization. In such a state civilization, there are no national minorities, and the principle of recognition of friend or foe is defined on the basis of a common culture." That politics begins from friend or foe is the basic fascist idea, formulated by the Nazi legal theorist Carl Schmitt and endorsed and propagated by Ilin. In writing of Russia as a civilization, Putin meant everyone whom he regarded as part of that civilization. Rather than speaking of the Ukrainian state, whose sovereignty, territorial integrity, and borders Russia officially recognized, Putin preferred to imagine the Ukrainians as a folk scattered across the broad expanse of what he defined as Russian territory, from the Carpathians to Kamchatka, and thus as an element of Russian civilization. If Ukrainians were simply one more Russian group, like Tatars, Jews, and Belarusians, then Ukrainian statehood was irrelevant, and Putin as a Russian leader had the right to speak for the Ukrainian people. He concluded with a cry of defiance, telling the world that Russians and Ukrainians would never be divided, and threatening war to those who failed to understand. "We have lived together for centuries. Together we triumphed in the most horrible of wars, and we will continue to live together. And to those who want to divide us, I can only say one thing. The day will never come." When Putin threw down that gauntlet in January 2012, no one in the West was paying attention. The issue in the headlines was that of Russian voters and their discontents. No one in Europe, America, or Ukraine was considering Russian-Ukrainian relations. And yet, Putin, moving very quickly, had formulated a politics of eternity that transformed Russians' protests against his fake elections into a European and American offensive against Russia in which Ukraine would be the field of battle. It was not, according to Putin, that individual Russians had been wronged because their votes did not count. It was that Russia as a civilization had been wronged because the West did not understand that Ukraine was Russian. It was not that Putin had weakened the Russian state by undermining its succession principle. It was that Europeans and Americans were challenging Russian civilization by recognizing Ukraine. In his first address to the Russian parliament as president in 2012, Putin affirmed this concept of the civilization state. No one was trying to divide the Russian Federation as a sovereign state with borders. But Ukraine was also a sovereign state with borders. That Ukraine was a different sovereign state than Russia was an elementary matter of international law, just as Canada was not the United States and Belgium was not France. By presenting the banal legal status quo as a violation of Russia's immaculate civilization, Putin was overthrowing a prevailing concept of law, one that Russia had observed for the previous two decades, in favor of particular claims from culture. Russia was not only innocent, but generous, went his reasoning, since only through Russian civilization could Ukrainians understand who they truly were. Even the most servile of Ukraine's leaders would have difficulty accepting Putin's description of their society. The president of Ukraine at the time, Viktor Yanukovych, was a known quantity in Russia and hardly a threat. Yanukovych had been disgraced in 2004 when a presidential election was stolen on his behalf, and Putin had been embarrassed when the election was held again and someone else won. The American political strategist Paul Manafort, at work on a plan to increase Russia's influence in the United States, was dispatched to Kiev to help Yanukovych. Under Manafort's tutelage, Yanukovych acquired some skills. Thanks to the corruption of his rivals, he gained a second chance. Yanukovych won the election of 2010 legitimately and began his term by offering Russia essentially everything that Ukraine could give, including basing rights for the Russian Navy on Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula until the year 2042. This made it impossible for Ukraine to consider joining the NATO alliance for at least three decades, as Ukrainians, Russians, and Americans understood at the time. Russia announced that it would expand its presence on the Black Sea by adding warships, frigates, submarines, troop landing ships, and new naval aircraft. A Russian expert pronounced that Russian forces would remain in their Black Sea ports until doomsday. Suddenly, in 2012, Putin's new doctrine challenged the very notion that Ukraine and Russia were legal equals who could sign a treaty. In 2013 and 2014, Russia would try to transform Yanukovych from a servile client into a powerless puppet, thereby inducing Ukrainians to rebel against a government that suspended their rights, copied repressive Russian legislation, and applied violence. Putin's idea of Russian civilization and his bullying of Yanukovych would bring revolution to Ukraine. Asked by students of history to name a historical authority, Putin could only think of one name, Ivan Ilyin. Now, Ilyin was many things, but he was no historian. If Ilyin's timeless regularities could replace historical time, if identity could replace policy, then the question of succession could perhaps be delayed. In his first address to the Russian parliament as president in 2012, Putin described his own place in the Russian timescape as the fulfillment of an eternal cycle, as the return of an ancient lord of Kiev, whom Russians call Vladimir. The politics of eternity requires points in the past to which the present can cycle, demonstrating the innocence of the country, the right to rule of its leader, and the pointlessness of thinking about the future. Putin's first such point was the year 988, when his namesake, an early medieval warlord known in his time as Volodymyr or Valdemar, converted to Christianity. In Putin's myth of the past, Volodymyr Valdemar was a Russian whose conversion linked forever the lands of today's Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. Putin's monastic friend, Tikhon Shevkunov, maintained that he who loves Russia and wishes it well can only pray for Vladimir, placed at the head of Russia by God's will. In this formulation, Vladimir Putin is the Russian Redeemer who emerges from beyond history by God's will and mystically incorporates a millennial Russian past simply by bearing a name. Time became a mystical loop, vacant of factuality. When a statue of Volodymyr Valdemar was unveiled in Moscow with the modern Russian spelling Vladimir, the Russian media was careful not to mention that the city of Moscow had not existed when Volodymyr Valdemar ruled. Instead, Russian television repeated that the new monument was the first such homage to the leader of Rus. This was untrue. In fact, a statue of Volodymyr Valdemar had been standing in Kiev since 1853. In history, the person in question was known as Volodymyr, as ruler of Kiev, and Valdemar to his Scandinavian relatives. He belonged to a clan of Vikings, known as the Rus, who had worked their way south along the Dnipro River in order to sell slaves at southerly ports. The Rus made Kiev their main trading post and eventually their capital. The death of each Viking warlord caused bloody struggles. Volodymyr Valdemar had been prince of Novgorod, where, according to Arab sources, he had converted to Islam in order to trade with nearby Muslim Bulgars. To win Kiev, Volodymyr Valdemar made for Scandinavia to seek military assistance against his brothers. He won the campaign and control of Rus. Volodymyr formalized the pagan rites of Kiev and had local Christians sacrificed to the god of thunder. At some point, Volodymyr married the sister of the Byzantine emperor, a political coup that required his conversion to Christianity. Only then did Christianity, rather than official paganism, become the source of legitimation of the ruler of Kiev. Christianity did not prevent parricidal, fratricidal, and filicidal warfare because it did not provide a succession principle. Volodymyr had imprisoned his son Sviatopolk and was marching on his son Yaroslav when he died in 1015. After Volodymyr's death, Sviatopolk killed three of his brothers, only to be defeated on the battlefield by his brother Yaroslav. Sviatopolk then brought in the Polish king and a Polish army to defeat Yaroslav, who, for his part, recruited an army of Pechenegs, people who had drunk from his grandfather's skull, to defeat Sviatopolk, who was killed in battle. Then yet another brother, Mstislav, marched on Yaroslav and defeated him, creating the conditions for a truce and joint rule between those two brothers. After Mstislav died in 1036, Yaroslav ruled alone. And so the succession from father Volodymyr to son Yaroslav took 17 years, and was complete only after 10 sons of Volodymyr were dead. The life and rule of Volodymyr Valdemar of Kiev, if seen as history rather than within a politics of eternity, does offer a lesson: the importance of a principle of succession. No doubt the Russian state can be maintained for a time by elective emergency and selective war. The very anxiety created by the lack of a succession principle can be projected abroad, creating real hostility and thus starting the whole process anew. In 2013, Russia began to seduce or bully its European neighbors into abandoning their own institutions and histories. If Russia could not become the West, let the West become Russia. If the flaws of American democracy could be exploited to elect a Russian client, then Putin could prove that the world outside is no better than Russia. Were the European Union or the United States to disintegrate during Putin's lifetime, he could cultivate an illusion of eternity. Chapter 3, Integration or Empire, 2013. Europe, however serious its numerous shortcomings and misdemeanors, has nevertheless acquired an awesomely precious, indeed priceless, dowry of skills and know-how, which it can still share with the rest of a planet that needs them now more than ever for its survival. Sigmund Bauman, 2013. A state with a principle of succession exists in time. A state that arranges its foreign relations exists in space. For Europeans of the 20th century, the central question was thus: after empire, what? When it was no longer possible for European powers to dominate large territories, how could the remnants and fragments maintain themselves as states? For a few decades, from the 1950s through the 2000s, the answer seemed self-evident. The creation, deepening, and enlargement of the European Union, a relationship among states known as integration. European empires had brought the first globalization, as well as its disastrous finales: the First World War, the Great Depression, the Second World War, the Holocaust. European integration provided a fundament for a second globalization, one that, in Europe at least, promised to be different. European integration lasted long enough that Europeans could take it for granted and forget the resonance and power of other political models. Yet history never ends, and alternatives always emerge. In 2013, the Russian Federation proposed an alternative to integration under the name Eurasia. Empire for Russia, nation-states for everyone else. One problem with this proposal was that the nation-state had proven itself to be untenable in Europe. In the history of Europe's great powers, imperialism blended into integration, with the nation-state hardly appearing. The major European powers had never been nation-states. Before the Second World War, they had been empires, where citizens and subjects were unequal. Afterwards, as they lost their empires, they had joined a process of European integration in which sovereignty was shared. The East European nation-states that had been founded as such had collapsed in the 1930s or 1940s. In 2013, there was every reason to suspect that, absent a larger European system, European states would also dissolve. One form of disintegration, that of the European Union, would very likely lead to another, the disintegration of the states of Europe. Russian leaders seemed to understand this. Unlike their European counterparts, they were openly discussing the 1930s. Russia's Eurasia project had its roots in the 1930s, precisely the decade when European nation-states collapsed into war. Eurasia became plausible in Russia as its leaders made integration impossible for their people. At the same time, the Kremlin rehabilitated fascist thinkers of the era and promoted contemporary Russian thinkers who recalled fascist ideas. The major Eurasianists of the 2010s, Alexander Dugin, Alexander Prokhanov, and Sergei Glazyov, revived or remade Nazi ideas for Russian purposes. In his time, Ivan Ilyin was in the mainstream when he believed that the future, like the past, belonged to empires. In the 1930s, the major question seemed to be whether the new empires would be of the extreme right or the extreme left. The First World War brought the collapse of the old European land empires, not only Ilyin's Russia, but the Habsburg monarchy, the German Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. Thereafter, an experiment in the creation of nation-states was undertaken on their territories. France tried to support these new entities, but during the Great Depression, ceded influence in Central and Eastern Europe to fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. When a Polish regional governor or a Romanian fascist pronounced that the era of liberal democracy was over, they were voicing a general European conviction, indeed one that was widely shared on the other side of the Atlantic. In the 1930s, the United States was an empire, in the sense that a large number of its Native American and African American subjects were not full citizens. Whether or not it would become a democracy was an open question. Many of its influential men thought not. George Kennan, an American diplomat who had become his country's outstanding strategic thinker, proposed in 1938 that the United States should go along the road which leads through constitutional change to the authoritarian state. Using the slogan America First, the famous aviator Charles Lindbergh called for sympathy with Nazis. The Second World War also taught Europeans that the choice was between fascism and communism, empires of the far right or far left. It began with an unstoppable alliance of the two extremes, a German-Soviet offensive military pact of August 1939 that quickly destroyed the European system by eliminating whole states. Germany had already demolished Austria and Czechoslovakia. The Wehrmacht and the Red Army together invaded and destroyed Poland, and then the Soviet Union occupied and annexed Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. With Soviet economic backing, Germany invaded and defeated France in 1940. The second stage of the war began in June 1941, when Hitler betrayed Stalin and Germany invaded the Soviet Union. Now the extremes were on opposite sides. Berlin's war aim was imperial, the control of the fertile soil of Soviet Ukraine, which, Hitler thought, would make of Germany a self-sufficient economy and a world power. As allies or as enemies, the far right and the far left seemed the only viable options. Even resistance to Nazi rule was usually led by communists. In general, the defeat of Nazi Germany in 1945 discredited fascism, either because Europeans came to see fascism as a moral disaster, or because fascism claimed to be about winning and lost. After the Red Army drove the Wehrmacht from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, Soviet power was established again in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and communist regimes took over in Romania, Poland, and Hungary. All countries where right-wing authoritarianism had seemed the work of destiny just a few years before. By 1950, communism extended across almost the entirety of the zone of nation-states that had been formed after the First World War. In the aftermath of the Second World War, as in the aftermath of the First, the European nation-state proved unsustainable. American economic power had been decisive to the course of the war. Although the United States was late to enter the military conflict in Europe, it supplied its British and Soviet allies. In post-war Europe, the United States subsidized economic cooperation in order to support the political center and undermine the extremes and thus, in the long run, create a stable market for its exports. This recognition that markets required a social basis was of a piece with American domestic policy. In the three post-war decades, the gap between rich and poor in the United States was narrowed. In the 1960s, the vote was extended to African Americans, reducing the imperial character of American politics. Although the Soviet Union and its East European satellites refused American aid after the war, West European states undertook a renewed experiment with the rule of law and democratic elections, with American financial support. Although the policies differed considerably from state to state, in general, Europe in these decades built a system of healthcare and social insurance that later generations would take for granted. In Western and Central Europe, the state would no longer be dependent upon empire, but could be rescued by integration. European integration began in 1951. Ilin died only 3 years later. Like the Russian thinkers and leaders who revived him a half century later, he never took European integration seriously. He preserved his Manichaean view of politics until the end. Russian empire meant salvation, and all other regimes marked various points on the slippery slope to Satanism. When Ilin looked at post-war Europe, he saw Spain and Portugal, maritime empires governed by right-wing dictators. He believed that Francisco Franco and Antonio de Oliveira Salazar had preserved the fascist legacy and would reconstitute the European fascist norm. In post-war Britain and France, Ilin saw empires rather than a constitutional monarchy and a republic, and presumed that the imperial element was the durable one. If European states were empires, wrote Ilin, it was natural that Russia was one and should remain one. Empire was the natural state of affairs, fascist empires would be most successful, Russia would be the perfect fascist empire. In the half-century between Ilin's death and his rehabilitation, a Europe of integration replaced the Europe of empire. Germany began the pattern. Defeated in war and divided thereafter, Germans accepted a proposition from neighboring France, and along with Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Italy, established a European coal and steel community in 1951. West Germany's leaders, Konrad Adenauer in particular, saw that the path to national sovereignty and unification led through European integration. As other European empires also lost their colonial wars and their colonial markets, this project broadened. Even Great Britain, the imperial superpower, joined the undertaking, along with Denmark and Ireland, in 1973. Portugal and Spain set a new pattern of losing colonies, replacing authoritarianism with parliamentary democracy, and then joining the European project, both in 1986. Europe was a soft landing after empire. By the 1980s, democracy through integration had become the norm in much of Europe. All of the members of what was then called the European Community were democracies, most of them markedly more prosperous than the communist regimes to their east. In the 1970s and 1980s, the gap in living standards between Western and Eastern Europe grew, as changes in communications made it harder to hide. As Mikhail Gorbachev tried to repair a Soviet state to rescue the Soviet economy, West European states were building a new political framework around economic cooperation. In 1992, a few months after the Soviet Union ceased to exist, the European Community was transformed into the European Union. This EU was the practice of the coordination of law, the acceptance of a shared high court, and an area of free trade and movement. It later became, for most of its members, a zone with a common border and a common currency. For most of the communist states of Eastern Europe, the European Union also proved to be a secure destination after empire, though in a different way. In the 1930s and 1940s, the East European states established after the First World War fell prey to German Empire or to Soviet Empire or to both. After the revolutions of 1989, newly elected leaders of the East European states that emerged from Soviet domination expressed their aspiration to join the European project. This return to Europe was a reaction to the lesson of 1918 and 1945, that without some larger structure, the nation-state is untenable. In 1993, the EU began to sign association agreements with East European states, beginning a legal relationship. Three principles of membership were established in the 1990s. Market economies able to handle competition, democracy and human rights, and the administrative capacity to implement European laws and regulations. In 2004 and 2007, seven post-communist states, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Slovenia, and three former Soviet republics, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, joined the European Union. In 2013, Croatia also joined the EU. The kind of small political unit that had failed after 1918 and after 1945 could now endure because there was a European order to support sovereignty. As of 2013, the EU included the metropoles of the old maritime empires that had disintegrated after the Second World War, as well as the former peripheries of the land empires that had disintegrated during or after the First. What the EU had not done by 2013 was extend to territory that had been within the original borders of the Soviet Union as established in 1922. In 2013, 20 years after its Western neighbors, Ukraine was negotiating an association agreement with the EU. At some later point, Ukrainian membership in the European Union might overcome this final barrier. Ukraine was the axis between the new Europe of integration and the old Europe of empire. Russians who wished to restore empire in the name of Eurasia would begin with Ukraine. The politics of integration were fundamentally different from the politics of empire. The EU was like an empire in that it was a large economic space. It was unlike an empire in that its organizing principle was equality rather than inequality. An imperial power does not recognize the political entities that it encounters in what it regards as colonial territories, and so it destroys or subverts them while claiming that they never existed. Europeans in Africa could claim that African political units did not exist and were not therefore subject to international law. Americans expanding westward could sign treaties with native nations and then disregard them on the logic that those nations were not sovereign. Germans invading Poland in 1939 argued that the Polish state did not exist. Soviets meeting them in the middle of the country made the exact same argument. Moscow denied the sovereign status of its neighbors when it occupied and annexed Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia in 1940, even going so far as to claim that prior service to those states was a crime. When Germany invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, it denied that it was invading a state, treating the peoples of the Soviet Union as colonial subjects. Throughout the history of European imperialism, European powers assumed that international law applied to their dealings with European peers, though not to their colonial domains where they accumulated power and wealth. In the Second World War, Europeans applied colonial principles to one another. Post-war integration was a return to the idea that law governed dealings among Europeans, as Europeans lost their colonies in Europe and then around the world. In the EU, treaties were meant to change economics, after which economics would alter politics. Recognition of sovereignty was the condition of the entire enterprise. European integration proceeded from the assumption that state borders were fixed and that change must proceed within and between states rather than by one invading another. Each member of the EU was supposed to be a rule of law state, with integration among them governed by law. The result by 2013 was a formidable, if vulnerable, creation. The EU's economy was larger than that of the United States, larger than that of China, and about 8 times larger than that of Russia. With its democratic procedures, welfare states, and environmental protection, the EU offered an alternative model to American, Russian, and Chinese inequality. It included most of the states regarded as the world's least corrupt. Lacking unified armed forces and convincing institutions of foreign policy, the EU depended upon law and economics for diplomacy as well as internal functioning. Its implicit foreign policy was to persuade leaders and societies who wished for access to European markets to embrace the rule of law and democracy. Citizens of non-member states who wanted European markets or values would pressure governments to negotiate with the EU and vote out leaders who failed to do so. This seemed to work in the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s. The EU's vulnerability was the European politics of inevitability, the fable of the wise nation. Citizens of West European member states thought that their nations had long existed and had made better choices as they learned from history, in particular learning from war in Europe that peace was a good thing. As European empires were forced to abandon colonies and join the process of integration, this fable of the wise nation smoothed the process, allowing Europeans to look away from both defeat in colonial wars and the atrocities they committed as they lost. In history, there was no era of the nation-state. Generally, with exceptions such as Finland, empire ended while integration began, with no interval in between. In the indispensable cases of Germany, France, Britain, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, and Portugal, there was no moment between empire and integration when the nation was sovereign and the state flourished in isolation. It is true that citizens of these countries unreflectively believe that their country has a history as a nation state. Generally, after a moment of reflection, they realize that this is not the case. Such reflection does not usually take place because history education throughout Europe is national. Lacking serious education in their own imperial pasts, and lacking the comparative knowledge that would allow them to see patterns, Europeans settled for a falsehood. The fable of the wise nation, learned in childhood, comforted adults by allowing them to forget the true difficulties of history. By reciting the fable of the wise nation, leaders and societies could praise themselves for choosing Europe, when in fact Europe was an existential need after empire. By the 2010s, citizens of East European states were making the same mistake, albeit in a different way. Although most of the anti-communist dissidents had seen the need for a return to Europe after 1989, actual membership in the European Union after 2004 or 2007 allowed for forgetfulness. The crises after the First and Second World Wars, when the nation-state as such had proven untenable, were recast as unique moments of national victimhood. Young East Europeans were not taught to reflect on the reasons for state failure in the 1930s or 1940s. Seeing themselves exclusively as innocent victims of German and Soviet empire, they celebrated the brief interwar moment when nation-states could be found on the territory of Eastern Europe. They forgot that these states were doomed not just by malice, but also by structure. Without a European order, they had little chance to survive. The EU never attempted to establish a common historical education for Europeans. As a result, the fable of the wise nation made it seem possible that nation-states, having chosen to enter Europe, could also choose to leave. A loop back to an imagined past could seem possible, even desirable. And so, a politics of inevitability created an opening for a politics of eternity. In the 2010s, nationalists and fascists who opposed the EU promised Europeans a return to an imaginary national history, and their opponents rarely saw the real problem. Because everyone accepted the fable of the wise nation, the EU was defined by both its supporters and opponents as a national choice rather than as a national necessity. The United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, of Nigel Farage in Great Britain, the Front National of Marine Le Pen in France, and the Freiheitliche Party of Heinz Christian Strache in Austria, for example, all resided comfortably in the politics of eternity. The leaders of one EU member state, Hungary, built a right-wing authoritarian regime inside the EU beginning in 2010. Another EU member state, Greece, faced financial collapse after the world financial crisis in 2008. Its voters moved to the far right or far left. Hungarian and Greek leaders began to see Chinese and Russian investment as an alternative route to the future. The explicit Russian rejection of a European future was something new. Russia was the first European post-imperial power not to see the EU as a safe landing for itself, as well as the first to attack integration in order to deny the possibility of sovereignty, prosperity, and democracy to others. When the Russian assault began, Europe's vulnerabilities were exposed, its populace thrived, and its future darkened. The great question of European history was again open because certain possibilities in Russia had been closed. Russia under Putin was unable to create a stable state with a succession principle and the rule of law. Because failure had to be presented as success, Russia had to present itself as a model for Europe rather than the other way around. This required that success be defined not in terms of prosperity and freedom, but in terms of sexuality and culture, and that the European Union and the United States be defined as threats, not because of anything they did, but because of the values they supposedly represented. Putin executed this maneuver with stunning rapidity as he returned to office as president in 2012. Until 2012, Russian leaders spoke favorably of European integration. Yeltsin accepted Europe as a model, at least rhetorically. Putin described the approach of the EU to Russia's border as an opportunity for cooperation. The eastward enlargement of NATO in 1999 was not presented by Putin as a threat. Instead, he tried to recruit the United States or NATO to cooperate with Russia to address what he saw as common security problems. After the United States was attacked by Islamist terrorists in 2001, Putin offered to cooperate with NATO in territories that bordered Russia. Putin did not present the EU enlargement of 2004 as a threat. On the contrary, he spoke favorably that year of future EU membership for Ukraine. In 2008, Putin attended the NATO summit in Bucharest. In 2009, Medvedev allowed American aircraft to fly over Russia to supply troops in Afghanistan. In 2010, Russia's ambassador to NATO, the radical nationalist Dmitry Rogozin, expressed his concern that NATO would leave Afghanistan. Rogozin complained of NATO's lack of fighting spirit, its mood of capitulation. He wanted NATO troops at Russia's border. The basic line of Russian foreign policy through 2011 was not that the European Union and the United States were threats. It was that they should cooperate with Russia as an equal. The decade of the 2000s was the lost opportunity for the creation of a Russian state that might have been seen as such. Russia managed no democratic changes of executive power. What had been an oligarchy of contending clans in the 1990s was transformed into a kleptocracy in which the state itself became the single oligarchical clan. Rather than monopolizing law, the Russian state under Putin monopolized corruption. To be sure, the state provided a measure of stability to its citizens in the 2000s thanks to exports of natural gas and oil. It did not deliver the promise of social advancement to the bulk of the Russian population. Russians who founded businesses could be arrested at any time for any imagined violation of the law, and very often they were. In matters of peace and war, Moscow also took actions that made it harder for Europeans to see Russia as an equal. In April 2007, Estonia was crippled for weeks in a major cyber attack. Although the event was confusing at the time, it was later understood to be the first salvo in a Russian cyber war against Europe and the United States. In August 2008, Russia invaded its neighbor Georgia and occupied some of its territories. The conventional assault was accompanied by cyber war. The president of Georgia lost control of his website, Georgia news agencies were hacked, and much of the country's internet traffic was blocked. Russia invaded Georgia to make European integration impossible for its neighbor, but was in fact renouncing it for itself. By the 2010s, oligarchy in the Russian Federation had made reform not just impossible but unthinkable. Writing for the German press in November 2010, Putin tried to have it both ways, arguing that the EU should integrate with Russia without expecting Russia to change in any way. Since the Russian Federation could not follow Europe's principles, went his reasoning, Europe should forget those principles. Putin was beginning to imagine a reverse integration, in which European states would become more like Russia, which would have meant the end of the EU. A signal difference between a Europe of empire and a Europe of integration was the attitude towards law. On this issue, Putin the politician was following the course of Ilin the philosopher. An early faith in law yielded to an endorsement of lawlessness as patriotic. Ilin's great concern as a young man in Russia before the revolution had been the spirit of the law. He believed that Russians needed to imbibe it, but could not see how. A century later, the boring EU had solved this problem. Its tedious process of accession involved the export of the spirit of the law. European integration was a means of transporting the idea of the rule of law from places where it functioned better to places where it functioned worse. In the 1990s, association agreements signed between the EU and aspiring members initiated legal relationships that included the implicit promise of a deeper legal relationship, namely full membership. The prospect of future membership made clear the benefits of the rule of law in a way that individual citizens could understand. The mature Ilin rejected the rule of law in favor of the arbitrariness, proizvol, of fascism. Having given up hope that Russia could be governed by law, he presented lawlessness, proizvol, as a patriotic virtue. Putin followed the same trajectory, citing Ilin as his authority. When he first ran for president in 2000, he spoke of the need for a dictatorship of the law. Those two concepts contradicted each other, and one of them fell away. Running for president in 2012, Putin rejected the idea of a European Russia, which meant ignoring external incentives that favor the rule of law. Instead, proizvol would be presented as redemptive patriotism. The operative concept in the Russian language today is bespredel, boundarylessness, the absence of limits, the ability of a leader to do anything. The word itself arose from criminal jargon. On this logic, Putin was not a failed statesman, but a national redeemer. What the EU might describe as failures of governance were to be experienced as the flowering of Russian innocence. Putin chose empire over integration. If the EU did not accept Russia's proposition to integrate with Russia, Putin explained in 2011 and 2012, Russia would help Europe to become Eurasian, more like itself. A Eurasian customs union with neighboring post-Soviet dictatorships Belarus and Kazakhstan was established on January 1, 2010, while Putin was prime minister. As a presidential candidate in late 2011 and early 2012, Putin proposed a more ambitious Eurasian Union, an alternative to the EU that would include its member states and thus assist in its demise. He described the Eurasian idea as the beginning of a new ideology and geopolitics for the world. Writing in newspaper Izvestia on October 3, 2011, Putin announced the grand project of Eurasia. Russia would bring together states that had not proven to be plausible members of the European Union, and, implicitly in the future, states that exited a collapsing European Union. This meant present and future dictatorships. In Nezavisimaya Gazeta, on January 23, 2012, Putin claimed, citing Ilin, that integration was not about common achievement, as the Europeans thought, but about what Putin called civilization. On Putin's logic, the rule of law ceased to be a general aspiration and became an aspect of a foreign Western civilization. Integration in Putin's sense was not about working with others, but about praising oneself, not about doing, but being. There was no need to do anything to make Russia more like Europe. Europe should become more like Russia. Of course, for the EU, coming to resemble Russia would have meant an undoing. In a third article in Moskovskaya Novosti in February 27, 2012, Putin drew that very conclusion. Russia could never become a member of the EU because of the unique place of Russia on the world political map, its role in history,